Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome you to the Commonwealth Club, those who are here live in San Francisco and on our radio and online audiences. And tonight, I'd like to introduce the introducer. The introducer for tonight's speaker is Jeffrey Farber. He is the CEO of Quart Foundation. He has been the CEO for the last 13 years. He spent a career at Bank of America, 30 years as a top officer there. And he's also on the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club. Jeff.
Thank you, George. As George said, I can't think of a more important night to introduce this program, and in particular, this speaker and his new book, than tonight. Joseph Tartakovsky is the author of The Lives of the Constitution, 10 Exceptional Minds That Shaped America's Supreme Law. In 2015, he was appointed Nevada's first Deputy Solicitor General, where he handled Nevada's docket in the U.S. Supreme Court. He is currently the James Wilson Fellow in Constitutional Law at the Claremont Institute for the Study of Statesmanship and Political Philosophy, and an editor at the Claremont Review of Books. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and LA Times, to name a few publications. As a lawyer, he has served as a white-collar criminal litigator at an international law firm and as a law clerk to a federal appellate judge. I've had the pleasure of knowing Joseph for over 20 years, and I'm most honored and proud to introduce him tonight to you, Joseph Tartakovsky.
Thank you, Jeff. Do I need this? I think I don't need this, right? Put it down. Well, thank you, Jeff, for that kind introduction. Thank you, George and the Commonwealth Club, for having me tonight. Thank you to all of you for coming here on such a lovely and, as it happens, constitutionally momentous Monday evening. We don't have much time together, so I thought I'd quickly just tell you a little bit about my book, what it's about, why I wrote it, some of the people in it, and then we can continue the conversation with questions. And I'm very grateful that you're here. I wrote this book because I wanted to figure out for myself how it was that we have now entered our third century under the Constitution. It's an extraordinary fact. France, a country that, like us, considers itself a beacon of world liberty, has had, since the time our Constitution took effect, a number of monarchies, two imperial republics, a few Napoleonic dynasties, a Vichy regime, and yet here we are, continuing under the same 18th century words. No people on earth has ever lived under a written constitution longer. And what I find is it's not just the text, as brilliant as it is, but we have in this country what I call a constitutional spirit, a set of assumptions, habits, traditions, some of which are not codified and which cannot be codified. Things like fair play, honesty, decency, loyalty to our constitutional order. We know that a good text is not enough because we see what happens in other countries. Russia is a country that, like us, has a constitution that purports to guarantee free speech and free press. But I was actually living in Russia in 2001 when the state took over the last independent TV station, just seized it, did exactly what our framers had in mind when they drafted the First Amendment. I mean, the king seizing the dissident printing presses. But the extraordinary thing was that the Russians just shrugged. They didn't care because they've never had a free press. So they have a text, just like ours, but it is absolutely meaningless in practice because they don't have the culture that makes it a real thing, that sustains it. The book is a history of America with a focus on our constitutional story. The only way I could think of to even begin to approach a topic as epic as our 230 years under the Constitution was to borrow the method of Plutarch or Lytton Strachey on the Victorians. You pick a number of figures at different junctures in our history, people who represent different tendencies, different times, different backgrounds, and follow them through their adventures in life and through the era and world in which they moved, and see what kind of lessons they offer us today, see how they overcame the challenges, the sort of challenges that I find perpetually recur in our history. Just quickly tell you who they are, and then we'll talk about three of them. I have Alexander Hamilton, the great founder. I have James Wilson, a founder who was almost as consequential as Alexander Hamilton, but you've probably never heard of him. I have Daniel Webster, the great senator who was the greatest constitutional lawyer in the first generation to follow the framers. I have Stephen Field, the first Supreme Court justice from California, appointed by Lincoln. I have two Europeans, Alexis de Tocqueville and James Bryce. Both of them came in the 19th century. Both tried to write the greatest book ever written about America. And for a while, they were actually in competition for that honor, although Tocqueville has since completely effaced and Bryce. I have Woodrow Wilson, the great president during the Progressive Era. I have Ida B. Wells Barnett, who I'll tell you about in a moment. I have Robert Jackson, who was FDR's attorney general and later Supreme Court justice. And then I have Antonin Scalia, who I'll also tell you about. I picked these 10 because they were just an interesting mix. Not too many justices. The Constitution looks different to a founder in Philadelphia in 1800 or a black woman in 1890 in Mississippi or a attorney general in Washington in 1940. Alexander Hamilton stands for me for the lesson that our constitutional culture to survive requires that we trust in government, in our institutions, and that our institutions and our government in turn deserve that trust. Alexander Hamilton, of course, was the island orphan, so poor that a judge had to buy him shoes for his mother's funeral, but has his way paid to America, gets involved in the war effort, joins Washington's inner circle, follows Washington into the first administration where he serves as Treasury Secretary. Hamilton was almost unique among the founders in his preoccupation with building up the government. He did this in an era of extraordinary political hate, probably the worst we've ever had, far worse than today. And if you need any proof of that, you may remember who killed Alexander Hamilton. Do you all remember? Do we remember in what capacity Aaron Burr was serving when he murdered Alexander Hamilton? The vice president. Did he have to leave the vice presidency after he murdered Aaron? No. And in fact, there's stories. I mean, I find them depressing, but there's stories that he would go give a speech to a Jeffersonian gathering in Virginia and get applause after he murdered. So until Vice President Pence, I won't. But one of the things that made the era so fraught is that we were a weak sort of sliver of a country wedged up against the sea. Two European empires on the continent. We couldn't control the sea. And it seemed at various junctures we were going to be invaded. And it was a quite real possibility that the government would fall. England, France, and then England again were the threats. Around 1797, the big fear was that France was going to invade. And John Adams summons George Washington out of retirement to create an army. And I'll give you an example of what happened to illustrate Hamilton's preoccupation with building up the trust in the government. Washington writes a letter to John Adams' war secretary, and he says, "Whatever you do, do not bring any Democrats." Democrats were the opposition party, Thomas Jefferson's party. "Do not bring them into the army because they're traitors. And if France invade, they will join the invaders." Washington believed that. Hamilton learns of it, sends another letter, says, "Washington's wrong." Now, you'd have to be a pretty bold person to contradict George Washington on a point of how to assemble an army. But Hamilton did it because he argued that if you do this, you will make the military a partisan institution. You will mean it'll mean that half of the country will not need to feel loyal to the government. You'll lose an opportunity to make friends to the government. George Washington's wrong. And so far as I can tell, that's the beginning of our tradition of a nonpartisan military, which, by the way, is nowhere written into the Constitution, but it has been essential to the preservation of our political liberties. I'll give you another example of how Hamilton accomplished what he did. Has anyone heard the name Maria Reynolds? She was the Stormy Daniels of the 1790s. Around this time that this letter writing campaign about the military was going on, rumors start in Congress that Hamilton is corrupt. He's been paying members of Congress to get their agenda through. This was the big charge against Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton writes a pamphlet and says, "It's not what you think. There's no political corruption here. I have been paying a woman named Maria Reynolds, but it's because I've been having a year-long affair with her, and I've been paying her, and she's an unstable prostitute, and I've been having to pay her to keep her quiet." This was the nation's first national sex scandal. Hamilton brought it upon himself, and he did it, as he wrote, because he needed to prove that he may have been a corrupt spouse, but he was not a corrupt official. Adultery was a much more serious thing than it is today. And Hamilton didn't need any ethics inquiry or Mueller or Whitewater. He didn't need any of that to get to the truth. He just put it in a pamphlet himself. And he did it because he needed to prove, he needed to disprove the one thing that could have undermined his work as Treasury Secretary. So he fell on his sword. Ida Wells Barnett. Ida Wells Barnett was a black woman born a slave in Mississippi in 1862. She became a school teacher in Memphis, and the event that changed her life was the murder of her best friend in a lynching. She began writing against the institution of lynching in the South, which for a black woman to do was absolutely unheard of. She's forced to flee to Chicago. She starts doing it on a national scale. And she becomes the single most important crusader we've ever had against lynching in this country. At the peak of her fame in the 1890s, she was probably second to Frederick Douglass in her renown as a black public intellectual. Ida Wells Barnett shows us how a constitutional culture requires, at some level, that every American play a part. She not only wrote about lynching, she pioneered what I would think of as criminal defense technique. She would go, if a black man was arrested for some purported crime, she would go to the jail. If she couldn't get there herself, she would send a white Pinkerton, interview the man, get the facts, see what had happened. She did this after a famous and unbelievably tragic massacre in Arkansas in 1919. She is one of the first to arrive on the scene, and what she finds, the facts. There had been a massacre of 100 black farmers, members of their family. Six black men are arrested for murder, but really just for fighting back. And the facts are so horrifying, facts like the state of Arkansas had set an execution date for these six men, but no one had bothered to set a trial date, that they decide to take a long shot to the Supreme Court, which to this point had barely lifted a finger to intervene in the sordid and medieval fiendishness that was the institution of lynching in the South for decades. And in 1923, they get this to the Supreme Court. In 1923, in a case called Moore versus Dempsey, the Supreme Court makes its first humanitarian intervention into lynching. It says, this is America, and we are not going to do that in this country. It's the first of its kind. The more famous cases come later, the Scottsboro Boys case in the 30s, And so it began there. She was not a lawyer. She was as outsider as you could possibly get. The other cause that Ida B. Wells Barnett had was women's suffrage, which seems to me the ultimate example of the way ordinary Americans create profound constitutional change. You may remember Seneca Falls was 1848, the first organized call for a women's right to vote. The 19th Amendment was 1920. There was apparently one young woman at Seneca Falls who survived to see the 19th Amendment. Now, what changed in those 70 years? It was activists, mostly women, convincing their brothers, uncles, fathers that this was justice for women. And in the suffrage fight, it actually seems to have come down at the critical moment to one person. And I'm quite sure you've never heard of Harry Burns' mom. Well, the 19th Amendment, just like any amendment, requires 3/4 of the states. In 1920, that was 36 states. By the summer of 1920, 35 had ratified. So the final showdown was going to be in Tennessee. Activists flood in from all over the country, and the Tennessee legislature is deadlocked. And at the last moment, a guy named Harry Burns switches his vote. He was a 24-year-old, rural East Tennessee, flips his vote. And he reveals that he did so because he got a note from his mother. And his mother said, "Dear Harry, I've been watching you. You haven't said anything. Be a good boy and vote for suffrage." And we have the note, and he did. And he later gave an interview, and he said that he knew that he was going to go down on record on this question for all time. He reflected on the fact that his mother had been educated. She had followed public affairs. And she was going to go to her grave never having voted for anyone in her entire life, even though the illiterate field hands on her farm could do so. I mean, this is one person at the right time taking the right action that gave 20 million women the right to vote. If she hadn't done that, if he hadn't voted that way, we don't know what would have happened. Maybe it would have gone on another year or two or five, just like it had for almost 40 years. The 19th Amendment was introduced in Congress every year for 40 years until it finally passed. I'll tell you about one last person, because I have to, because as far as I know, there may have been an announcement within the last few minutes of a nominee. That's Antonin Scalia. I'll tell you about Antonin Scalia, because regardless of your views of his politics or his jurisprudence, he spent 25 years of his life advancing a warning to Americans. And that warning was about the way in which courts, in particular the U.S. Supreme Court, in decision after decision, was deciding things that had once been the prerogative of Democratic majorities. Questions related to prisons, schools, welfare, free speech, abortion, national security, constitutionalizing them, saying that this is the Constitution has spoken on this particular question. Because when the Constitution speaks on it, that is to say the justices speak on it. And he thought this was a trend that was an accelerating thing. And it's an extraordinary thing. It exists in no other country where you have 9 people who have the power to decide something for all time in all 50 states for 320 million people. And his warning was that particularly on what you might think of as social or cultural questions, you have to be very careful, because the people have the right to do stupid things, the people have the right to make mistakes, and the people should have the right to change their mind. And I'll just give you one illustration. Where we're seeing our culture change in front of us. This is the question of sexual assault, rape. A California judge just lost his seat, the first judge recalled in 80 years, because he was perceived as giving too lenient a sentence to a sexual assaulter. There was a case called Coker versus Georgia in 1977. This is a death penalty case. And what I'm about to say, this is not an argument for the death penalty. I want to illustrate for you how this process works that I'm describing. There's a guy named Ehrlich Coker. He was serving multiple life sentences in a Georgia prison for a rape murder and then another rape. He escapes from his Georgia prison. He breaks into the home of Elnita and Alan Carver, who lived nearby. He ties him up. He rapes her. And the question for the Supreme Court was, can Georgia execute someone for the crime of rape? The court said no. And the court said it was disproportionate. And this is the court's reasoning. This is a quote from the Supreme Court opinion, that for the victim of a rape, life may not be nearly so happy as it was before, but it is not over, and normally it is not beyond repair. Now, the court never said how they knew that Elnita was so likely to recover. She was 16 at the time. She had just given birth a few weeks earlier. But the court in that moment decided that for all time, in all 50 states, not only could you not execute people for the crime of rape, which actually had been relatively infrequent, there were racial disparities, which is a separate issue, but had been not that infrequent, but that a state couldn't even threaten rapists with execution. Even if you could show, and there's hard evidence for all these propositions, that some rapists inflict as much social and individual harm as some murderers, it's like a Coker who's raped three women, or that some women, in fact, never recover, that it leads them to self-hatred, depression, the suicide rates for rape victims are something like 13 times normal women, an unraped woman. I worked at the Nevada Attorney General's office where one of our initiatives was to test all rape kits. There's a backlog in most states. And one of the things that surprised us was that some women don't want to know. They do not want to know their assailant because they've spent too many years trying to overcome the pain. That's how this works. And we're seeing our culture change. We are recognizing today that sexual assault inflicts far more harm than we ever imagined. It echoes through women's lives and even through their children's lives. That's why you have to be careful about this process. Let me say one last thing and I'll stop and we can do questions. There's a lot of despair around today. I understand much of it. This is part of a series on crisis in our country. I hope you won't mind me saying that I found in writing this book that our country is actually perpetually in crisis, that it could be no other way, that there are founders told us so themselves. And in fact, the founders probably, to them we owe our constitutional hypochondria, because they were the first to predict that the constitutional republic would fail. Our friend Hamilton, 2 years before he died, wrote a letter to Gouverneur Morris, who had been at the convention, wondering why he had wasted so much of his life defending our frail and worthless, that's his words, constitution. John Marshall, 30 years later, this is the John Marshall who had served as Chief Justice of the United States for 30 years by this point, who had done everything he could do to firm up our Constitution and our country. He wrote a private letter. This is his heartfelt conviction to Joseph Story, saying, "I've yielded reluctantly to the belief that our Constitution cannot last. And yet here we are." Now, what's the difference between us and the founders? 200 years. 200 years of under a constitution, almost without interruption, overcoming invasions, pandemics, presidential assassinations, world wars, depressions, great and small, every variety of constitutional crisis you could ever imagine. We've overcome every single one of them. This country, this government is an experiment. That's how the framers almost universally referred to it. That's how we should continue to think about it. But we all have a duty to do our part to pass on this very precious inheritance unimpaired. The founders believed it was an experiment, but they undertook it with a certain spirit at its best, a mix of courage and caution, of idealism and practicality. That was the spirit that created this astonishing government, and I'm convinced that that is the only spirit that will preserve it. And so with that, I'm very grateful that you came and happy to take your questions. Thank you very much.
I'd like to remind our audience to listen to Joseph Tartakovsky at the Commonwealth Club, and we'll take questions.
Has the nominee been announced? Is anyone? Kavanaugh. So that the smart money seemed to have been on Kavanaugh. So he's sort of a so Kavanaugh has long been a sort of leading light of the world of conservative jurisprudence, pretty stellar background. His extensive experience in government. He was associate counsel in the second Bush administration, worked under Kenneth Starr in the Whitewater investigation, and has been on the D.C. Circuit for a number of years. My sense is he's kind of like a John Roberts. I mean, definitely more John Roberts than Scalia. Although getting on the Supreme Court has a way of changing people, but that's my sense. So he'll be a solid conservative with a compromising tendency.
I heard today that our Vice President Mike Pence has stated that the Bible supersedes the Constitution. And I would like to know your response to this, what significance you feel it has.
He said that?
Yes.
Wow. Well, that I can tell you is a matter of constitutional law. That's not correct. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. The Supreme Court, actually, in a case called Reynolds, had said that no man is above the law, so that this was the polygamy case. And they said the Bible authorizes this behavior. The Supreme Court said that Constitution, you are not exempt from the supreme law of the land just because you claim to have a religious reason that sets you above or outside of it. We've changed on this question. You know, the Supreme Court in a case called Holy Trinity Church said that this is a Christian country, a decision written by a guy named Justice Brewer, who was the nephew of Stephen Field, who's in my book. And he had written a book called America's a Christian Country before he became a justice. He had been a missionary in Asia. And then a 100 years later, to the year, the Supreme Court issued its decision on whether you can offer it was a very mild ecumenical prayer at a middle school graduation. The Supreme Court said you can't do that. So the Bible was fairly close to the center of power for a long time in this country, but there's been some distance created in our law. So it is not the law. And I think his lawyers will advise him of such.
Probably already did.
Yeah.
Hi. First, thank you for your presentation tonight. And secondly, I am Asian American, first generation born here in the United States. And, actually, my question has to do with the current lawsuit brought by Students for Fair Admissions against Harvard University for discrimination on the basis of race. And I would say, you know, the 14th Amendment should protect Asians from racial discrimination. And I think when the White House administration said, okay, Harvard, I think you need to roll back on some of your criteria in this area. It seems that, you know, we're in a blue state, okay, and our California government says there should be no racial discrimination in our public institutions like University of California and so forth. And it really shouldn't be a conservative or liberal, blue or red state kind of issue, but it seems that it is the Republican White House that is saying, that's right, you know, Harvard shouldn't be discriminating on the basis of race. And one thing I really wanted to bring out is that, you know, over the passage of time, at some point we have to say, okay, we have to stop bending over backwards for underperforming groups. And then we also have to acknowledge that there are minorities that have been discriminated even by law on the basis of race, especially in California, against Chinese and Japanese, for example. And there are just so many qualified Asian Americans now who do not deserve to be discriminated mm-hmm. against in these universities. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, that's a very difficult policy question. As a constitutional matter, my prediction is that the decisions that upheld affirmative action, Gratz, Grutter, I think probably rest on shaky ground with the new conservative majority that's going to emerge. Because the Supreme Court did a very weird thing. The position of the conservatives, like the Clarence Thomas and the Scalia, was to say that the Constitution is colorblind. That's a famous doctrine in this country, that the Constitution does not recognize race. In other words, there's almost no reason that the law should take account of an individual's race. Now, that's not strictly true. I mean, we had the Freedmen's Bureau after the war, for instance, that gave preferential treatment to freed blacks. But it's almost universally true. There's almost no laws that actually sort of make discriminations on the basis of race. That's why all the fights are over sort of disparate impact, something like that. And the Supreme Court did this very weird thing where they said that we know that affirmative action is in tension with this constitutional principle, so far as it bears on public universities, of course, because this is the 14th Amendment, which only restricts state actors. But they said that you could do it in order to remedy past discrimination, and they threw out 20 years for some reason. Like, it could be a time-limited sort of thing. So it seemed to be very much a political compromise on the court, that most of that time has since elapsed. So someone is probably getting the next challenge ready to that now. And I don't think it's going to fare too well.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Could you speak just briefly about the idea of the living constitution? Is there an intellectual or some person that's most associated with that idea as opposed to the strict constructionist approach?
Yeah, sure, and that's a great question. So the living constitution is the idea that the constitution ought to reflect changing norms and values of the day. But where the confusion is the it comes down to the question of who decides. Who decides? Who does the updating? Who does the renovation work? And the living constitution as a legal doctrine, I think, really only properly applies to the court of the 60s and 70s, most famously William Brennan. I mean, he seems to be the apostle of living constitutionalism. For instance, he decided that criminal obscenity laws were unconstitutional. Now, criminal obscenity laws existed at the time of the founding and for most of our history. The men that drafted the First Amendment also drafted criminal obscenity laws. But he once gave an interview saying that he had just come to the conclusion that they're too vague. Just, you cannot draft a proper one. And so he decided in his chambers that America would not have these laws anymore. That should be distinguished from the idea that the Constitution, our interpretations of it, change. Our interpretations of the Constitution change continuously. The Commerce Clause meant something different in a world where you lived in your village, you rarely ventured outside of it, your whole life was contained, and a world where, for instance, to buy my book on Amazon, there's six or seven states involved in the manufacturing and the sale and the shipping. We've become more interconnected, and for that reason, our interpretation of the Commerce Clause has expanded. I gave you an example of how our views of religion as a public matter, its place in public life, has receded. That's unquestionably true. Even the supposed opponents of living constitutionalism recognize that. Give you one example, Scalia. A few years ago, they decided a case called Riley. It had always been the law for 200-something years that if you are, as a matter of criminal procedure, if you are arrested, the police can go through everything in your pocket. You know, you happen to be caught committing a burglary and you have your diary, it's all without a warrant, the police can get it. And the question came, what about your smartphone? And the court said, you need a warrant. And the reasoning was that unlike every other object that anyone has ever had in their pocket, on your smartphone, you have more information about your family, financial, medical emails, more than what the police could find in your entire house. And they changed the constitutional law with respect to arrest, something that happens tens of thousands of times every day, all because of an innovation made in Cupertino, smartphones. 9-0. So Scalia too, Clarence Thomas too, are changing our constitutional law, the Fourth Amendment, in response to changing American conditions. And if we didn't do that, we wouldn't have a constitution, if it didn't adapt. The hostility toward living constitutionalism is to what extent judges ought to exercise that power as opposed to deferring to the political branches.
Next question.
I have a question. I was just curious if you could speak to the process that you went through in deciding the 10 individuals that you were going to spotlight throughout the book, just what the research was and kind of your thought process behind it.
Sure. Thanks. With great difficulty. I mean, I could have had 200 exceptional minds. I could have maybe a few volumes, 15 volumes. I picked people that interested me that had said things that I thought were interesting. For instance, Ida Wells Barnett, I first discovered her when I came across a quote that she had written where she said that every black family should have a Winchester rifle in their home in a place of honor. That's like a very interesting thing for a black Chicago mother to say. There's a lot of history contained in that argument, because for most of our history, African Americans lived in a world where the police – and many still feel this way, but the police were part of the lynch mobs, and they protected the lynchers. You had to protect yourself. So I discovered these people in interesting ways. I tried where I could to pick people who were not as famous, the Stephen Fields, Ida Wells, the Robert Jacksons, or if they were famous, like a Woodrow Wilson or a Hamilton, to shed light on angles that I think have been ignored. At first, I had too many justices. I believe that our constitutional story is not just a bunch of court cases. I mean, reading court cases, which, sad to say, most constitutional books are sort of recitations of court cases, I find a very boring way to, and a very sterile way to approach the richness that is our constitutional story. And I pick these people, and to get the chronological periods right, and try to get the right stories in. My method was just to sort of read everything I could about everything they had written, read everything as much as I could, as like my lifespan would permit, you know, to learn about their era, and then just try to compose them into little essays that tell their story. And I try to make it short. By the way, 220 pages, short book. And another point, there are 10 figures in the book, but there's lots and lots of bit players and cameos. I mean, hundreds of them. So we have Madison and Lincoln's in a number of chapters, and Susan B. Anthony. And so I just don't want you to think that you could pay all this money for this book and you only get 10 people. You get hundreds of them.
Next question.
Thanks. Thank you. Well, I do have the book in 220 pages. I read about lots of people and I loved it. So
thank you.
Thank you. I have a question about something that's come up recently, and it plays a little bit off what you were saying with they make a decision for 50 states for all time, and that is this question of overturning precedent. And there's been a lot of discussion with Kennedy's retirement about if some justice is going to come in and they're going to overturn Roe versus Wade. That's always the big thing that comes up. And I wondered if in your history of study you had looked at when precedents get overturned, and what's involved, and what are some of the interesting aspects that come into play when something like that happens? How controversial is it? How much does it divide the court generally? As a court historian and observer of this process, is there anything you'd care to say about what happens when that causes precedents to get overturned, or what happens in the country when they do?
Sure. There have been a number of famous examples. It depends on the issue. Sometimes the court does it because they have a test. The Supreme Court has a test. If the reasoning of the decision has clearly been undermined, if it's usually something like that. What you find is that sometimes it does it because the composition of the court changes, the decision becomes outdated. Sometimes it does it because of immense political pressure, even though the court is supposed to be immune. Supreme Court once said that dollar bills, greenbacks, were unconstitutional. You know, and the disruption was so immense that within 4 years they reversed it. The Supreme Court declared the death penalty unconstitutional in the 70s, and a few years later they had to reverse it as a result of public outcry. But you will also find, and maybe this is most relevant to the abortion, is that Americans have views about these policy issues. And just because the Supreme Court speaks doesn't mean that the debate stops. The Supreme Court said that in Casey, which is a decision in 1993 that in ways overruled Roe. And they said that, look, there are times when the court has to call together the contending sides in a social debate and say, we all have to follow the Constitution and let's just stop fighting. And that has not been the case with abortion. Ruth Bader Ginsburg laments the decision because she thinks it instigated the social tension because you close off democratic avenues of deciding these things. But American views go in a certain way, and even the court can't stop it, which I think is a nice thing to see sometimes. Supreme Court in the 80s said that the right of gay sex, of consensual gay sex, was facetious. Now, that didn't stop the movement towards legalizing the broader gay rights fight, which is why I think that if the Supreme Court had said that gay marriage is not constitutional, we still would have seen the continuation of the movement. I think with abortion, abortion is an unusually difficult one where the court, the fight just seems to go on, and Scalia would say this is what I was warning you about. He said that the court shouldn't be in the business of deciding on abortion because now it has created this political focus on the court. I mean, this is the test. They say, what are your views on Roe v. Wade? And then every nominee says, well, I never really thought about that. Scalia was confirmed unanimously. So was O'Connor. Even though she had a record of voting for abortion rights as a legislator in Arizona, but now it's just become so fraught. And this is not the way it was meant to be. That the addition of one individual to a court for life, who makes decisions that you cannot reach, the sense that Americans have that fundamental liberties turn on the identity of one or two people, the court was not supposed to be that powerful. And it has become that powerful because it has gotten into so many of these areas on which, at least in an argument from a Scalia, the Constitution is silent on it. I would call on you, but he is.
Thank you.
We have another question if you're after.
Okay. You mentioned the Constitution lasting a very, very long time. Over the 200-plus years, we've seen some very bad decisions, even though the Constitution is pretty clear, like Plessy versus Ferguson, that says that, separate is equal, even after the 14th was passed. Some of the most important things that the court has done was in spite of the fact that the Constitution was fairly silent, like privacy, which led to, Roe v. Wade and gay rights and gay marriage and so forth. And then other things like free speech really evolved with the society. So my question is the Constitution itself the thing that really drove America to be what it is, or society changing? And if my last observation is that if you look at other countries, modern countries, European countries that have arguably better systems in terms of campaign finance, in terms of free press, even free speech and other things, but without the similar kind of constitutional backing. So what do you say to the fact that perhaps the Constitution itself is not necessary, but society itself is more important?
So it's a very good question. And the question basically boils down to the one of whether it is the people, something about our character that created the regime, our constitutional regime, or does the Constitution shape our character as a people? This was the question that actually drew de Tocqueville and Bryce to this country. They were of the view that this democracy was coming, like a worldwide tidal wave to all the world and Europe first. And they wanted to know if there's something exceptional about America. and they had different answers. We know a few things. We know that culture predates the Constitution, our constitutional spirit, these tendencies and habits, because where did the men who wrote the Constitution, where did they get their principles? We know they didn't get it from the Constitution. They put it into the Constitution. And you could trace it back to English practice or all the way back to ancient Rome or Greece if you want. I have the sense that if you took our Constitution and just sort of transplanted it in, say, a Turkmenistan, probably last a year or two, but then there would, you know, there'd be some kind of collision, there'd be some crisis, and it would just unravel. At the same time, we know that the law does have this profound effect in preserving liberty. I mean, having a legal order enshrined in something like a constitution. We know that because we have at least three examples where you have had a common culture, hundreds of years of common history, language, everything. North Korea, South Korea, China, Taiwan, East Germany, West Germany. You take this country, you cut it in half, you put them under different legal regimes, and one produces BMWs and Samsungs, and the other one produces gulags and secret police. So we know that the nature of the regime makes a big difference. I hope you won't think it's a dodge when I say that I found that you can never fully disentangle the two things. But if I had to pick, I would say that it's the culture, that without without this, in the end and above all, this deep instinctive loyalty that we have to this, to our constitutional order, it wouldn't work. It's not just a bunch of rules that just go of themselves. We have to believe in it. Officials have to believe in it for the thing to work. And there's going to be lots of, I compared in the book to a card game where, you know, people can cheat here and there, they make mistakes. But so long as most of the people are playing honestly, it works. If more people are cheating than actually playing the game, it ceases in point of fact to be a card game. But the culture is so important because that's how we've shaped the Constitution. I mean, you bring up Plessy versus Ferguson. I hope it's not too, I hope it won't seem too controversial if I say that Plessy versus Ferguson actually makes perfect sense at the time it was decided. And this was a country that was racist by our standards. What the Plessy court said is, they said, look, yes, African Americans have political equality. They can serve on juries. They can vote. But that doesn't mean that they have the right to go on trains with us. I once read every decision that the Plessy court cited, and they cited cases from state Supreme Courts, northern ones like Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. These state liberty-oriented states, and they said the same thing. That's just what America was. But it took the lawyer who brought the case. It was very controversial. His friend said, "Do not bring this case because you're going to get the Supreme Court to write segregation into our Supreme Law. You're going to lose. You're going to set back the cause that may have happened." But no one except. But back to the overruling question, Americans didn't say, "Well, I guess that's that." You know, no, that. Activists kept fighting. They said, no, this is not how we as a country interpret the 14th Amendment. It is a stigma on fellow citizens, and we don't accept it. And eventually you push back, and it begins with activists at a grassroots level, not with justices or presidents. And we change our Constitution, and we've done it again and again. And we should be proud of the trajectory towards ever greater inclusion and justice, I think. Thank you. Thank you.
Congratulations, thank Joseph you. Tartakovsky. I am reading a book by Harry Frankfurt called On Bullshit, which was printed by Princeton University Press. He's a Princeton University philosophy professor emeritus. And he talks about humbug as the polite word to use. And we have now, it's the highest office in our land, a master of humbug. And I'll also say, secondly, I have a good friend who has a JD and a PhD in sociology and clerked for Judge Noonan in the 9th District Appellate Court. He told me a year ago that if you're going to impeach him, it will be on the Emoluments Clause. What do you think about that?
So the Emoluments Clause is a provision in the Constitution that says that a president cannot receive any outside income during his term of office. It's an anti-corruption provision. The idea is you can't get gifts from a foreign king. There is, until President Trump, there has been no case law ever developed on the Emoluments Clause. When I first heard about it, I thought it was sort of like a political attack because it's not been like an actually litigated I thought it was a political attack, but I've actually become more interested in it. And the suit by a number of members of Congress is actually progressing. Presidents have always had outside income, and we know that, Washington or Jackson, they kept their farm going. But the question becomes, when does it become problematic? So what the argument in the Emoluments Clause case is that the president has – he's an extraordinarily wealthy man. He has hotels in Washington, D.C. Representatives of foreign governments have said that they were going to have an event at the Four Seasons, but they move it to the Trump Hotel because they don't want to piss off the president for not staying at his hotel, and that's how they do it in their country. So he seems to be – his family seems to be making money off. It's to be investigated. I thought the one president that for sure there would be precedent on was Herbert Hoover, because Herbert Hoover is also very wealthy, and he had been a mining executive and investor, so he had mining income from all over the world. And I actually know his the dean of Hoover biographers, and I actually wrote him when this Emoluments Clause started, and he said, actually, Hoover was careful to divest all of his mining income before he actually became Commerce Secretary. I thought, well, okay, well, that's something. I don't know if the Trump administration, if their counsel has written a memo about how he's supposed to do this. I mean, Barack Obama had a book, that they sell and they were selling apparently in, foreign embassies, or, he was making money that he became president. But he wrote the book before he became president. I don't know if you can require a president to sort of the problem seems if you're steering, you're using the office to steer yourself. So we may get litigation. One court already has dismissed it, saying this is for Congress. Congress deals with it. But for most of our history, it's been stuff like, the Prince of Bavaria gave Teddy Roosevelt like a big bear skin, and can he keep it? And they say, no, you can't do that. Or if it's like something very small, that's what the Emoluments Clause has been.
Well, the great irony for that, though, and is that once Trump announced that he was running for president, even though he didn't seem to have a chance at first, the problem already existed and there was no way around it because he owned real estate and other things all across the world. And if anybody had bought them for inflated prices, they would be enriching him before they got into office instead of afterwards. And now that he's been president for a while, the same thing, if you told him he had to divest it all, the people would line up to buy it all. And, mm-hmm. and very inflated prices. So there's just no way out of the problem, I think, under the circumstances.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I wanted to get back to the strict constructionist versus the living constitution. Mm-hmm. And I found that Thomas Jefferson was really one of the first advocates of a living constitution, which you can see just by visiting his memorial in Washington. And on it, he says, I am not an advocate for frequent changes in laws and constitutions, but laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind as that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, new truths discovered, and manners and opinions change. And with these change of circumstances, I'll abbreviate here, we might as well require a man to wear still the coat that fitted him when he was a small boy, and in civilized society, to remain having this coat, the same coat, is the regimen of their barbarous ways. So I just like your opinion on Jefferson's take on the Constitution.
So that's a great letter, especially because he used the word progressive in that letter like four or five times. So if you took a snippet from that quote, it would look like something straight out of Woodrow Wilson or straight out of a press release from Nancy Pelosi. He keeps saying we have to adapt to the changing time. We have to make this country more progressive. Jefferson, I think – but this is the distinction. Jefferson was of the view that our institutions had to change to reflect custom. He said that letter. He said things about how we shouldn't have sanctimonious reverence for the Constitution. Look on it as something that can't be touched. But when it came to judges, he invented what we call strict constructionism. He coined the term in a memo that he wrote to Washington when the question came up, which was the most fraught constitutional question for the first 40 years of our existence, which was, can Congress create a bank? The famous bank fight. This is Hamilton and Madison wrote the Federalist Papers together, and then they, as soon as the bank fight began, they went, they stopped being friends and they went toe-to-toe on this. Washington asked Hamilton for a memo. Hamilton says you need to read the Constitution with breadth and flexibility and creativity. And Jefferson says you need to read it strictly. You need to strictly construe it. And he says, I have a copy of the Constitution. It does not mention a bank anywhere in there. Jefferson was the apostle of the view that the Constitution was something of restriction. Now, it doesn't mean institutions couldn't change, but he wanted it to be done he was hostile to the idea that the federal government had this sort of latitude. And so I think Jefferson is a good example of someone who believed that our constitutions required updating, adaptation to the times. But one of his great hatreds was of the federal judiciary, and of John Marshall was sort of a mortal enemy, a mutual mortal enemy. In the Midnight Judges.
And Adam, a cousin, right?
And a cousin. Yeah, they hated each other for some reason. Jefferson abolished a number of judicial offices. I think there was no inconsistency there. It's just a question of how we define living constitutionalism. And so he was of the view that you keep it out of the judge's hands. Jefferson, I think, was also the first and last person, just one other indication of his hatred. He was the first and last president to attempt a real impeachment of a Supreme Court justice. Now Samuel Chase, who was sort of campaigning and making overt political statements from the bench while riding circuit. And it failed, and Jefferson said, my guess is no one will ever try this again. What happened? I mean, you can impeach justices. It's in the Constitution, but that there's this constitutional culture that asserted itself. Americans have a deep reverence for judicial independence, and we're very wary of going after judges for their opinions. We just say, look, if you want to fix the court, you just got to get a new president, appoint new people. It's just yet another one of these unwritten but very deep and consequential elements of our constitutional culture.
You mentioned de Tocqueville and Bryce as the two foreigners that you covered, and you said that de Tocqueville obviously has overshadowed Bryce. What was Bryce's take, a little bit on how he looked at what we were doing?
So I think that Bryce wrote the better book. No one. It's not going to get anyone to read. I mean, it's 1,400 pages. It needs to be abridged. But Bryce was the better observer, because Bryce was more attentive, I think, to our Constitution. Tocqueville didn't actually think all that much about our Constitution. For instance, they both asked the question, why does it seem to be more prestigious to be in the Senate as opposed to the House? And Tocqueville said, well, it's people that are chosen by state legislators. So they're chosen by, they're elected by elected people. That's how it was in that time. And he thought, well, that just kind of adds a luster to it. And Bryce was more likely, he took out his Constitution, said that, well, they serve 6 years instead of two. They have extensive powers over judicial positions and foreign affairs. And so that's why Tocqueville was sort of focused on our culture. But he missed a lot. He didn't care about many emblems of early Americanness, like railroads, universities, literature, banking, manufacturing. So, and Bryce's book is delightful in many ways. But Tocqueville, like Jefferson, I find has eclipsed him, because Tocqueville just seems to have been one of the greatest producers of useful quotations that has ever lived. And he was very conscious of that too. I mean, he says, you know, Americans love politics more than anything. And it's perfect. Like, you need a speech, you need to go to, like, you know, WikiQuote. And then we'll have another line, Americans hate politics more than anything. And he's on both sides of so many things. But I probably should have done that in my book. I should have been on every side of everything, because it's a good quality to have.
Well, we have time for one more question.
There's been some recent talk about whoever controls the Senate, the House, the presidency
could say, well, I think now we're going to start having 13 justices on the Supreme Court because there's nothing in the Constitution that prohibits it. What's your thought about changing the, you know, and what would happen to this country if all of a sudden one side or the other decided to legally pack the courts?
Court packing. So here's my view on court packing. This is something that occurred to people early on. Daniel Webster noted in 1831 that you could dilute the Constitution by appointing justices. Woodrow Wilson talked about how you could overwhelm the opposition of the judiciary. People noticed that you could do this because, in fact, the Constitution doesn't spell out how many justices you have to have. We've had a low of 5 and a high of 10 at various junctures. My view is that to pack the court would be to destroy the judiciary as an effective branch of government, that this is what the court does, is there a check on the other branches, and if you can tamper with the court, you will destroy it. The only person ever to attempt it was FDR. But I do try to relate FDR's case in the book. So it's members of the left that are making the case for court packing, that a Trump court will destroy fundamental liberties, and so you have to take extreme measures to resist it. But you want here's FDR's case for court packing. FDR in 1936 is elected in the landslide of the century. He wins 46 out of 48 states. And yet, he was the first president ever to have a full term go by without getting a single pick on the court. Warren Harding got 4 in 2.5 years. And FDR believed that we were in a moment of crisis, existential depression, and the Supreme Court, one after another, was striking down every major initiative of his. 7 major laws, like Obamacare proportion laws, one after another, by a court that he believed was acting overtly politically. And he knew that because the dissenters on the court were saying these are crotchety justices imposing their views of economic liberty. And so he proposed packing the court. Robert Jackson, who's in the book, was at the heart of that fight. And he campaigned and defended the court packing plan. FDR lost. And it's one of the most interesting constitutional episodes in our history. It was killed by his own party. Now, part of it had to do with the way he went about it. He approached it with a very disingenuous way. He said that it has to do with judges being behind on their workload and their aging, and so we just need fresh blood. But Robert Jackson wrote a whole book, which I talk about in mine, called "The Struggle for Judicial Supremacy," and he takes credit. He says FDR won. That FDR's court reform bill lost, but FDR achieved court reform. And Jackson never tired of pointing out that the court flipped. You remember the famous switch in time that saved 9? One justice flipped on an issue that was identical to one he decided the other way about a year earlier. And after that, the court started upholding FDR's programs, and it didn't touch a piece of New Deal legislation for 40 years. And Jackson said, we didn't need... In the end, it shows we didn't need new justices or new constitutional amendments. We just needed a more enlightened view on the part of the personnel on the court. But it just strikes me as a brush with something very dangerous. I mean, if there had been a precedent created to change the composition of the court, it's an example of it would have been consistent with the letter of the Constitution. But the Democratic Party killed it because they said it was inconsistent with the spirit of the Constitution. You should remember that when you hear people say, you know, all we just follow the text, because it would have been a very bad thing, I think. It would have been like what's going on in Poland. So I don't think it's a possibility even, because if Democrats had the power to pack the court, they would have the power to change the composition in the traditional way. But I am against it, and I guess that's just because I'm a believer in just not tampering with the Constitution unless it's absolutely essential.
And that's a great place to end, because the spirit of the Constitution won and the spirit of the culture won at the same time, because FDR got his way without violating it.
Yeah.
So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion.
One more.
All rise. All rise.